Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff and welcome to the Bookomi podcast, original memorable insights, OMI, from the most wanted minds in business, science, tech and culture. In this episode, we meet the psychological scientist who wants us to rethink evil, to speak the unspeakable and accept as human beings we're all capable of cruelty, even when it comes to those we love and care for.
Many of us, the disproportionate number of us, have murder fantasies. And so we fantasize about killing people, usually from men. According to research, this is colleagues or strangers, whereas for women, it's most often family members.
Dr. Julia Shaw is best known for her work in the areas of memory and criminal psychology. Her new book, Evil, The Science Behind Humanity's Dark Side, gets inside the brain to help you find your evil empathy. Julia, welcome to Bookomi.
Wonderful to be here.
Now, you're a scientist who studies people doing their worst. How does that make you feel, generally, about the human race? You seem very positive.
I mean, I'm at heart, I'm a nihilist, but an optimistic nihilist. So I feel like that probably comes through in the book. I mean, that the human condition is so fascinating in so many ways, and specifically identity and, you know, tricky thoughts that we have and things that we might consider taboo in terms of thoughts or behaviors. Those are the things that fascinate me the most. And so I don't know if I could say whether I think humans are fundamentally good or bad. I don't think I would tend towards good. But I think that it's studying what makes us human that's so fascinating. Also, my cat just walked in.
So
if you hear random purring, that's what's going on.
It's not you.
Just picture a very cute gray cat with a very fluffy face. She's so cute.
Is she evil? Cats are evil.
Cats are little murder machines.
Let's get scientific for a second. What's happening in the brain when someone does something bad to another person or to the world at large?
Well, I mean, loads of things are happening in the brain, but one of the ways in which we can sort of spot one of the pathways, neural pathways, to evil, if you will, not that I think we should actually be using that term, but to bad behavior, is when we de-individuate and we dehumanize. So de-individuate means that we lose a sense of self. And so we, for example, feel like we're part of only part of a group. And so our individual, the me, gets lost. And I also thereby share responsibility and attribute sort of bad behavior potentially then to the group and group processes rather than to me as an individual. And then the other piece of that is dehumanizing others. And in the brain, that's, I mean, turning off your empathy, basically, making decisions based on the wrong things. And so in the brain, again, like, it doesn't look particularly different most of the time. It's just that certain things aren't active that you might have to more intentionally engage if you are trying to, you know, see the humanity in other people. And so dehumanizing, as I'm sure you're aware, but it just means that you see someone, a human being, as less than human or not human at all. And so it makes it much, much more easy to harm them because, well, you know, just like we eat animals and we kill animals, you can then justify atrocity towards humans much more readily.
Part of the thesis of the book is how awareness of what's happening in our brain will help us better understand our behavior and the behavior of others. But is it something that can be turned on or off? You say, oh, your empathy's being switched off, like your prefrontal cortex is overactive. Can we suppress the elements or the pathways in our brain or enhance them to make us either more or less empathetic and less likely to de-individuate or dehumanize people?
Yeah, I mean, there are fundamental differences between individuals as to how readily they, if you will, engage their empathy. And I think a notable example that we're all familiar with is psychopaths. And psychopaths are worse, if you will, at empathy. They're less likely. So their brains, their empathy centers just don't light up as quickly. And for other reasons, potentially. And so it's easier to do harm when you're a psychopath because you don't feel what other people are feeling. And so for most of us, it's a major inhibitor if someone is sad or crying or angry, and then we stop because we don't like how that makes us feel. And so psychopaths often don't have that. That doesn't mean that they have to engage in bad behavior. And this is something I talk about in the book, is that there's also such a thing as a pro-social psychopath. There's, you know, people who, sure, maybe don't have that empathy lighting up in the way that a healthy brain might or a non-psychopathic brain might, but they're still making the decision not to sort of engage in harm towards another person. So there's different aspects. There's the sort of fundamental feelings piece, and then there's the related but separate piece of behavior. And we always need to make sure to not sort of assume that our I mean, our brains make us do everything because they are all of our thoughts. It's not shifting responsibility onto something else. That is still you, and you are able to often override that.
You quote the German philosopher Nietzsche throughout the book, focusing on his notion that evil is a subjective experience and doesn't exist of itself. But surely we all know evil when we see it.
I'm not sure that's true. So I think that people's definition of evil and who or what is evil varies hugely. I mean, even within a group of friends. I mean, even gay rights, not in my group of friends particularly, but certainly if I even go out to wider family, you might have disagreements as to whether, for example, a gay couple should be allowed to get married. And to me, it's, you know, a huge problem and a violation of what I would consider sort of fundamental rights that we should attribute and give to everybody. If you don't allow people to have the same legal protection, if you don't allow people to marry just because they're gay. But not everyone will agree with that. And some people will think that the very act of homosexuality is evil. And so there's so much nuance in this word. And we use it still, despite this, as if it's a subjective thing, as if we all agree that this is the worst possible behavior or person. But that's not actually what we think. And I think much more interesting is whenever someone uses the word evil is to ask them what they mean. Because if you keep pressing people, so, you know, is it violence? Is it this predilection? Is it, you know, dig, and almost always people's concept of that person or action will be deconstructed and fall away. So Nietzsche, as you brought up, he has really interesting explorations and thought experiments around evil and where it's come from. And he also blames it on, you know, religious concepts of evil, which of course the sort of idea of sort of also ties in with things like the devil and hell. And it's a much more literal construction in some ways of evil than maybe an atheist might talk about. That being said, Nietzsche also has a dark side. So even my favorite people, Nietzsche, Hannah Arendt are some of my favorite thinking-wise, my favorite thinkers. But Nietzsche was hugely sexist, wrote long pages and pages about how women are inferior and shouldn't be engaging in things like philosophy. So I'm sure he would be unhappy about the fact that I'm even quoting him potentially. And Hannah Arendt, who also wrote on evil and Eichmann's trial. She believed in segregation and was basically a racist and wrote articles about that. But I think that really illustrates it, is that even people you admire, even people you think are amazing in some ways, everybody has aspects of them that you might disagree with or think are evil or bad. I do try to pay tribute to all the researchers in the field of, if you will, evil, if that's a field, but in related disciplines who I think have inspired certainly my thinking on this topic.
So we can think evil thoughts, or we can admire what we consider evil thoughts in others, as long as we don't act upon them, as long as we don't behave badly. Is that what keeps us good as humans?
Yeah, I mean, as a criminal psychologist, which is what my background is, it's always fascinated me. There's a couple quotes. So one of the things, that one of the mantras in some ways, is that the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. So that's something that, like, from day one in criminal psychology is like drilled into you, is that, you know, if you're doing a risk assessment, the single best, you know, predictor is past behavior. But that, of course, is incomplete, because there's so many people who decide to stop doing whatever it is they've been doing before, whether that's habits, positive ones, or negative things like antisocial behavior or crime. But this balance between thoughts and actions, the other thing that criminal psychologists often say as an alternate term for offenders is bad decision makers. I think that actually does capture it often, is that, you know, crime is usually a bad decision. And it's either the result of a prefrontal cortex that hasn't planned something sufficiently, and so you haven't accounted for the consequences of your actions appropriately, and so you engage in a behavior that is actually destructive to you, or it's something you have planned, but is still destructive to you or the people around you. And so I think that's where we sort of underestimate also that there are huge differences in people's ability to make decisions and in like the thoroughness of their decisions. And so in this book, what I'm trying to do all the time is thought experiments to help you think through the worst possible situations and some less horrible situations, where it's almost like an ethical, moral health check, where you get to role play in your brain, you know, some horrible things and think through some horrible things. And ultimately, I think doing that at a time when you have the capacity to, So when you're just sitting there and you're healthy and you're, you know, you're not in a war, you're not in a high conflict situation, you're able to think these situations through so that if those moments happen, you're better prepared and you're making better decisions. So in my view, making evil, the one main thing it hopefully does is it helps you think through really difficult but interesting things in a systematic way so that you can make better decisions in the future and avoid acting in line with things that people might call evil. I don't like the term evil. I think we should stop calling people evil because it risks dehumanizing them in the very word.
You shouldn't have put it on the front cover of your book then.
It's called Making Evil. The US likes evil and the UK likes making evil. In the US, it's just evil, potentially. So I also don't know what it is in Japanese or in Korean. It could be something horrible. For all I know, there's some really weird covers. One is like melting sheep, and they look fantastically weird. And in German, evil isn't a word. So this is another thing I realized, is that evil as a word doesn't exist in quite a lot of countries. So Russian, I think, also doesn't have a word for evil in the way that we do in English. And it's so in German, it's bad with a capital B, and so that's the title is bad. Like very bad, which I quite like as well. So it's even that shows sort of how our language literally constructs the conceptualization we might have around it as well.
When we think of serial killers in history, why do we always think of men?
Oh, it's almost a trap. So why are serial killers mostly men? Well, I mean, most violence is perpetrated by men. So in the book, I talk about murder and statistics around murder and who does the murdering, basically, and killing more widely. And it's almost exclusively men killing other men. Now, this is also taking out of like war context, in which case it's also mostly men killing other men. But even just in sort of other kinds of violence or assaults or murder, it's almost exclusively men. Now, why? That's an excellent question. Sometimes you hear what I call the testosterone myth, which is that men are built to be violent because they have all this testosterone. Now, that sounds on the surface like it might make sense, but if you look at the history of where that came from, it's not a good history. And it started basically that there was a scientist who was doing research on animals, on roosters specifically, and he cut off the testes of one of his chickens and put it into another, and then decided that because the one with the extra testosterone was more aggressive, the one with no balls was not aggressive, and the one with normal balls basically was normal aggressive, that there must be something in this hormonal system that is leading to aggression. So it's literally back to cocks, if you will. I wanted to put this joke into my book and they wouldn't let me. Our research on testosterone is literally based on cocks. And from there on, what happened is that from this very small sample, so it was six chickens that this was done on. So basically the research on testosterone is based on research on cocks, and six cocks specifically. And from there on, the assumption basically just was that it must be testosterone and that's it. And that was sort of done and dusted. And from there on, anything that supported that was just thrown into the pile of evidence. And it was seen as, hey, this is why men are violent. That, of course, ignores the fact that A, women have testosterone as well. And B, so many men are not violent. Like, if it is just the testosterone, then that doesn't explain whatsoever differences between countries and differences between individuals who have the same amount of testosterone. So on a fundamental level, I mean, women and men are all capable. Every human, no matter the gender, is capable of harm and doing the worst things you can think of. But in terms of who has done it, it is disproportionately men, and so disproportionately men that it is almost exclusively, you could even argue, especially when we're talking about things like murder, it's almost exclusively men killing, and also this other men. So both the victims and the perpetrators are disproportionately male.
So what is it down to then if it isn't testosterone?
I think it's about socialization. It's, you know, what we let little boys and little girls get away with, what we encourage them to do and feel and think. And in some ways, we're failing, I think, our boys and our men by not having higher standards and expectations around, you know, not engaging in violence.
So we as a society are making men evil. We're responsible for that.
Yeah, and within that, I want to be careful not to, again, blame women. So not to blame sort of mothers, because I don't think it's that simple. I think it's a social issue. I think that we are not encouraging empathy in boys. We're not encouraging self-control to the same extent as we do, for example, with girls. And I mean, simultaneously, on the other side, we should be encouraging girls to also be a bit more, you know, maybe sometimes a little bit less self-control, a little bit less self-conscious. And so somewhere, maybe there's a happy medium somewhere there that we should all be striving for. But it's certainly not the case that men are built to be violent. I think it is entirely decision-making that's failed.
So how do you explain why it's mostly women that are into true crime and the gorier the better? And also the people that collect murder objects, like murderabilia, I think it's called.
So, I mean, the fascination with true crime and with, if you will, evil, I mean, it's not new. I mean, if you think about it, all the way back to like gladiator fights, or if you think about you know, public hangings. I mean, there's been a long history of also sort of watching cruelty towards others in public arenas. And so this isn't new. It's not new to think about and talk about offenders and to, you know, gossip in some ways also around people who might be a threat to you and your family and your friends. But I think that potentially the reason that we're seeing higher figures for women than for men, it's a good question. I mean, it might be that women, because they're not engaging in this kind of behavior or thought process as much, feel like it's something more curious. So it's something more different from their own thinking patterns and their own behavior. And so it's a little bit more interesting, because if it's so different from you, it might have more appeal than if it's something you've thought or maybe even done before yourself.
You talked earlier about how memory and your special field of, you know, memory and predicting behavior, is what people consume as entertainment a useful prediction or a useful tool to predict what their behavior will be like in real life?
No. So I would say no. So I think that in general, actually, so there's also research showing that many of us, the disproportionate number of us, have murder fantasies. And so we fantasize about killing people, usually for men. According to research, this is colleagues or strangers, whereas for women, it's most often family members and people they know. Now, why do we have murder fantasies? Why? I think this is related to why we like true crime and why we consume media around offenses and around serial killers and around criminals in general. And it actually seems to be the case, well, some evolutionary psychologists have argued anyway, that we are going through these thought experiments, and maybe specifically people who are able to go through these thought experiments of what would it be like to kill someone, or who engage with media around crime and sort of think it through and play it through, they might realize that the consequences are absolutely not what they want. And so in the end, make better decisions, and, you know, if there's a moment where they might otherwise engage in the actual act. So I think that it can potentially be protective to have a safe place to think through these situations, to play it out and realize that the consequences are terrible. But with true crime and crime shows, there is also the problem that we make, for example, serial killers into celebrities. And that is an issue that I think does encourage more people to harm others who are seeking celebrity. So that I think is a whole next level. And that's where murderabilia ties in, is that that also is reinforcing that we have made people into celebrities when people are buying goods that were once owned by serial killers, which you can go online and just, you can buy like a delouser that, you know, with the, you know, famous serial killers used in prison. I mean, it's ludicrous and often gross, the stuff that you can buy, but there's a whole market for it. And that we are all complicit in when we share, especially things that murderers themselves want us to share. And the same is true for terrorists. We are specifically achieving their goals for them if we spread their message.
And finally, can we talk about groupthink and culture? How do you think the world is responding to the threat of the pandemic? Does it fill you with hope, or does fear make us act badly?
So I wrote a piece on COVID when it first started, and evil, if you will. And it was because I kept hearing and feeling, frankly, the sentiment that sort of people who were still going outside when they were told to be in lockdown, that they were evil, basically, that they were bad people, that they were selfish, that they were doing all these things to intentionally harm others. And so we can very quickly fall into what's known in psychology as the fundamental attribution bias, which is where we attribute, you know, intent. So where someone does something bad, so they are bad, is sort of the thought that follows. And so someone going outside during lockdown must be doing it intentionally and must be therefore a bad person because, you know, this because of this bad behavior. Whereas in reality, it's unfortunately much more complicated. Not to excuse their behavior, but I think that we do need to contextualize bad behavior and social group behavior in a pandemic. But ultimately, the best thing you can do, I think, is live by example. And this is true for COVID or other things, is that if you want people in your immediate environment at the very least and in your social network to behave a certain way, is to do that and to show it and to show the benefits of living that way and how you're doing it effectively, and that is contagious. So overall, the response to COVID, at least as far as I can see, has filled me with hope. I think people are complying and are much more socially conscious of protecting each other than we were expecting.
Well, there's nothing like an existential threat to make people feel togetherness, is there?
Yeah, well, for most people anyway.
Your article on lockdown distorting our memories and sense of time by denying us mental landmarks was fascinating. What are your tips for making the most of the time and making sense of the time and the memories that we're creating in lockdown?
So as someone who studies false memories, so memories of things that didn't actually happen, I am concerned about the sort of melting of time that lots of people are reporting. Also because inevitably we will be sharing our memories of what we did during lockdown later on. So, I mean, whether it's next year or in 20 years, people will be asking us about, you know, what did you do? What was it like? And if you want a correct answer to that and not just a distorted one that's in hindsight, one big blur of time, you need to create your own landmarks. And landmarks are basically memories that stick out. And they're usually associated with positive or negative emotion, but let's go with positive if you're creating your own. And it, normally that would be things like going out to an event where, you know, something exciting happens, or going to, let's say, a wedding or other milestones in your life or in the lives of others around you. And basically what your brain does is it uses that as a benchmark to say, you know, other things happened before or after that thing. So let's say you went to a friend's wedding. You could say, you know, it was before Susie's wedding or after Susie's wedding. And so it helps your brain organize time. And so to create that yourself, you need to put in effort. So the way that I do it with my partner is we have theme nights around different countries that we haven't been to. We did, for example, Bangladesh. And so we cooked the national dish. We listened to all the podcasts we could find, especially political podcasts, but also other podcasts around the country, and like to get a sense of what people are thinking and what's important politically in that country. And then we watched a documentary, or sometimes we watch other films related to that country. And so it's a real, like, it's a whole process, really. We wear the colors of the flag. I mean, it's, and the more effort you put into these things, the more likely they are going to be landmarks and they're actually going to stick out. Plus you learn stuff and it's fun. But I mean, there's obviously different ways you could do that. But people say to me quite often, oh, that sounds like a lot of work. It's like, yeah, that's why it works. It works because it's a lot of work.
Well, Julia, spending time with you and your book has been a landmark for me. So thank you for sharing your OMI with Bookomi.
Well, thanks for having me.
So by seemingly ignoring the lockdown rules, Dominic Cummings isn't evil or bad. He just does evil, bad things in the eyes of some people. And the press swarming around his house, coughing and spluttering their disgust on each other, aren't evil either. They're just doing bad things to get a good look at the bad man. Dr. Julia Shaw's book, Making Evil, The Science Behind Humanity's Dark Side, is published by Canongate and is on Bookomi's Most Wanted list for May 2020. If you'd like to hear and meet the brightest minds in business, science, technology and culture, you can sign up to our monthly Most Wanted email at bookomi.com. For news of upcoming guests and access to our author intelligence service for clubs and companies. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bookomi podcast, please reveal your feelings by liking, following or subscribing on Apple, Spotify and Google audio platforms, or any other platform, as many exist. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Be good, be safe, and be sure to get your eyes tested before you drive.